Another one is on the way. He knows the girl will do as he's told her. He's become expert at taking over their minds, changing their thinking, making them forget anything they left behind. He makes it so that the only thing that exists is right now, this moment, and the next fix. It works every time. He has no idea, though, that this time, one of the girls they've chosen will be the last. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 180, The Barbershop. This episode is sponsored by Krypton Signs. You probably don't know this about me, but in my previous life, like pre-podcast, not pre-birth, I worked at a signage company for 12 years. Yeah, I'm one of those lifer employees. I still have a really soft spot for the signage industry, which I know sounds weird, but there's something about helping people to create one of the most important parts of branding for their business that feels like you're making a real difference. So when Krypton Signs wanted to come on board as a sponsor for the podcast, I thought that was a really cool full circle moment. If you're looking to make a bold statement with your business, Krypton Signs will bring your brand to life with custom signage that stands out. Whether you need eye-catching storefront signs, event banners, or vehicle wraps, they've got you covered. No job is too big or too small, and they deliver top quality results fast. Krypton Signs offers free consultations to help you design the perfect sign for your business. If you're ready to make your business impossible to ignore, visit the lovely folks over at Krypton Signs at www.kryptonsigns.co.za or call 069-409-7112 today for a free quote. That's Krypton Signs, your signage, your way. Call 069-409-7112 now and get started. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. The subject matter of this episode is pretty relevant right now. Human trafficking is all over the headlines, with legal proceedings against two mothers ongoing as it's alleged they've sold their children into some form of trafficking. I covered human trafficking in a series of three episodes on the podcast in which I discussed the various aspects of trafficking, how it happens, who are the most vulnerable victims of trafficking, and the numerous purposes for trafficking in persons. In today's episode, you'll hear about a case of what human trafficking looks like in real life and how it plays out right in front of us, maybe in the house next door to you. Please note that this episode contains reference to the abuse and sexual assault of minors. In researching this episode, I used the sentencing document from the case, a few media articles, several academic papers about human trafficking that reference this case, and an article in the Sivamus magazine. So, let's get into episode 180, The Barbershop.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
In this episode, I will not be able to introduce you to the victims in the way I would usually like to. This is because the victims are minors, and they are rape survivors. For their own protection and to ensure the integrity of the case, their testimony was also led in a closed courtroom, and details of that testimony, although referred to in part in the sentencing document, has not been released in its entirety. One of the girls was referred to as Zandile in the court documents, and I will use the pseudonyms of Tandi and Unati for the other two girls. There's also a 17-year-old accused in the matter, who, although she is named in the media and court documents, I have chosen to give a pseudonym to because testimony would reveal that she too was a victim of trafficking at one point, and as is the case with many victims, was coerced into becoming a perpetrator. I will call her Anele. 8th Street in Springs, Gauteng, is a mixture of business and homes. It's a buzzing street with much coming and going. Business residents of the street include car mechanics, lawyers, cleaning companies, tax consultants, and at number 76, in 2017, there was a barbershop. The property at number 76 also advertised a few other services on the outside, including the purchasing of gold items and a tuck shop with a small takeaway business. The front of the barbershop was boldly painted. The business owner certainly wasn't trying to blend in to the rest of the street. Bold burgundy letters painted on the front near the roof declare its name, Looking Good Barbershop. There's a painted image of a woman cutting a man's hair, and then further down the words in black, Men and Women, and Good People, In You We Trust. The man at the helm of the barbershop was Edozi Obi. The 42-year-old man was a Nigerian national. He was born and raised in Nigeria as one of 9 children, and as an adult, he married and had 4 children with his wife. His family remained behind in Nigeria, while Edozi spent most of his time in South Africa, tending to his business interests. And if you're thinking that his business interests were the barbershop, the takeaway, and a gold exchange, you would be only partially correct. Those businesses were actually running from the premises in 8th Street, but only superficially. There was a small tuck shop with Cokes and packets of crisps, but other packages were also handed over the counter there. And there was indeed a single barber chair in the barbershop, in which customers would occasionally sit and have their hair cut. But even there, it was underneath the feet of the customers, as well as in other rooms of the property, where the true nature of Edozi Obi's business was revealed. I think it's at this point that the case starts to veer towards some of the images we might see presented in movies and fictional retellings. I'm always quick to say that human trafficking isn't what you see in the movies, but this case really does have a lot of those elements. if you were to go into the looking good barbershop for a haircut and sit in the chair, not far from where you sat, you might notice a bulge in the carpet on the floor. If you lifted that carpet, you would find a trapdoor. And if you lifted that trapdoor, you would enter an underground area. The people who worked at the barbershop called the dungeon. The dungeon, it would later be said, was used for punishment and for hiding young girls who were not supposed to be at the barbershop during police raids. For quite some time, only one young girl would be hidden in the dungeon. Her name was Zandile, and she'd left her home in 2016, fully intending to return home that night. But she hadn't. Not because she didn't want to, but because she couldn't. 13-year-old Zandile's nightmare started when she met 17-year-old Anele, who convinced the girl she could offer her a part-time job with training in a barbershop. As I mentioned earlier, there's very little information available about the background of these victims. But considering Zandile jumped at the opportunity, I can only assume that her family, if she had any, was struggling financially, and school was not a priority. While this is shocking and unacceptable to many of us, it is a very real lived experience for many children in South Africa. We also don't know where Zandile came from, but it's likely she came from another province and was lured digitally and coaxed by Anele, as we do know that the next two victims came from Mpumalanga. Soon, Zandile was in Springs, in 8th Street, and arriving at number 76. At first, it would have all looked exactly as Anele had said it would. It was a barbershop. There was a chair, equipment, and perhaps even a client or two. The veil of normality may have lasted for a few hours. But then he appeared, and everything changed. Evidence from all the victims and the eventual co-accused would later confirm that there was a clear pattern to what young girls arriving at Looking Good Barbershop would experience. It was well thought out and clearly planned, with one goal in mind: completely dominate and control the victims. Idozi Obi immediately became a terrifying figure, towering over the young victim. He would quickly inform them that they would not be leaving, and they now worked for him. Then some of his product from the tuck shop would be brought in. The product, manufactured on the premises, was colloquially referred to as rocks, and is actually so-called crack cocaine. Crack is a derivative of cocaine. It's produced by mixing cocaine with water and baking soda to create a mixture that eventually forms solid crystals. The crystals make a cracking sound when they're burned to be smoked, and that's where the name comes from. Because of the way it's made, and because it's smoked rather than snorted like powdered cocaine, crack is far more potent. It is also much cheaper than cocaine, and as a result, has become a major scourge in communities. The effects of smoking crack are instant from the very first use. The drug is classified as a stimulant or upper, which relates to the fact that it causes a high characterized by an extreme energy boost, increased alertness, and an elevated mood. As a stimulant, crack affects the central nervous system by causing an imbalance of neurotransmitters in the brain. It is highly addictive, with many users reporting that they were hooked from their very first use. Edozie Obi was manufacturing crack on the premises and selling it, and he used it to immediately turn the young girls who had been lured to his barbershop into addicts. But that was not the end game. For the victims, it was just the beginning of the horror. Edozie Obi's main business was forced sex work. The young girls whose essential abduction he arranged would be made to work in the sex work establishment he ran in two rooms at the back of the barbershop property. The victims almost always came into the barbershop in their very early teens. And as part of his campaign of terror and forcing the victims into submission, Obi raped the victims several times before he started selling them to customers. Every single girl told the same story. They were brought to the barbershop with a false story by Anele, forced to smoke crack until they became addicted, given hardly any food, beaten, raped by Obi, and then raped by the men who paid him to rape them. Sandile would spend almost a full year at the barbershop. She lost track of the days in the end. Her young life now a haze of violence and hunger for a drug she was completely dependent on to feel physically normal. And though she was terrified and for the most part just did what she was told to survive, Sandile had not forgotten what normal life looked like. And she did try to escape. Perhaps one of the most devastating parts of this case is that Sandile did escape. And once, she even made it all the way to a police officer. But she had no idea that fate had led her to the wrong man. There were a few of them, in fact, it would later emerge. Police officers who had been paid off by Obi to turn a blind eye. Some who even took their payment by raping the victims themselves. And Sandile's escape attempts were always thwarted. She was brought back to the barbershop by the police officer she thought she could trust. And she was punished endlessly. Until finally, she resigned herself to what she thought was going to be the rest of her life. The paid-off police officers did seem to be in the minority, thankfully, because Sandile would often have to hide in the dungeon when the raids came. But almost always, they knew when it would be, because Obi had been tipped off, and there were no drugs or victims of human trafficking to be found when the raids happened. And so, Zandile's nightmare continued. The neighbours in 8th Street had seen the young girls coming and going from the barbershop. Occasionally, Anele would have the girls stand outside, dressed in skimpy outfits. Many of the other business people in the street would later say they'd reported this to the police. Mostly, nothing would happen. But sometimes, there would be a raid. But, of course, Obi always knew. And the girls would disappear for a while, and then they would be back. If anyone ever tried to make conversation with one of the girls in the street, Anele would step in. Mostly, people could see the girls were on something. Their eyes were vacant. Anele would claim they were her sisters or her cousins, visiting for a while, and any conversations quickly came to an end. In May 2017, Sandile watched as another girl arrived at the barbershop. Tandi's first few horrific days had barely passed when yet another girl, Unati, arrived. Both girls were immediately put through the same inhumane initiations Andile had suffered a year before. She could only watch through now hazy eyes, knowing exactly what was to come for them. Anele was constantly putting her feelers out to recruit new victims, but many attempts didn't work out. Parents would become aware, or the girls would be hesitant and not follow through with the plan. Then two girls in 2 days were successfully lured by Anele. The last girl who arrived at the barbershop, Unati, was from Balfour, Mpumalanga, and her parents immediately sprung into action when she went missing, and they got lucky by virtue of finding themselves talking to an investigating officer in Mpumalanga who was committed to pushing through. When he spoke to Unati's parents about the girl's disappearance, he immediately realized that she was not a runaway. She had no history of behavior that might point to her being involved with the wrong crowd or having an older boyfriend. So the investigating officer started looking at some of Unati's cell phone activity and talking to people in the neighborhood, especially at the taxi rank, where she would have had to have gone if she was headed out of Balfour on her own or with someone else. The trail led him to Springs in Gauteng less than 24 hours later. And if any of the officers there were among those paid off by Edozi Obi, they were outnumbered on this day by those who were not. Even if there was some undercover conspiracy in the local police to help keep Obi's operation running, now that an outside station had identified a missing child having found their way to the barbershop, it would have been almost impossible to stop the ultimate outcome, regardless of how much the dirty cops wanted to. On the 19th of May 2017, 8th Street in Springs was overrun with police cars. Gawking residents watched as heavily armed police officers smashed their way into the barbershop. This was unlike previous raids. There was no knocking and showing of warrants. There were no tip-offs this time. And the three victims were found huddled together in the back rooms. There had been no time to push them into the dungeon that day. Zandile likely felt no surge of joy that day, though. She'd been let down too many times in the last year by those in police uniforms. Tandi and Unati, though, through their drugged haze, breathed a sigh of relief. 17-year-old Anele and a drug runner who worked for Edozi Obi, called Luke Buerta, were arrested. Two others were also arrested, but they've never been identified as charges against them would later be dropped. And soon, the kingpin was in custody too. Edozi Obi's run had come to an end. The man, it would later be revealed, had a surprisingly sparse criminal record. He'd had a theft conviction a few decades before, and a charge of possession of drugs, which had gone nowhere. And perhaps it's not that surprising, really, because it's very clear he had a way with a golden handshake and probably bought off more than a few police officers in his time. He denied any knowledge of what police had found at the barbershop, claiming he just oversaw the hair-cutting, takeaway and gold business, and he couldn't speak for what his employees were doing while he wasn't there. When the group first appeared in court on the 23rd of May, the media's focus was not on the apparent kingpin of the operation, though. It was on the young woman who'd lured the girls to the barbershop, 17-year-old Anele. Undoubtedly, her age and gender played a role in the focus being on her. How could a fellow woman and someone so young be involved in such a horrific criminal ring? And the answer to why and how soon became clear. Anele had also been lured to the bob shop. She too had been given crack cocaine to smoke and become addicted. She too had been abused and sold by Idozi Obi. Anele's mother told a journalist that her daughter had gone missing just before she turned 15. Her mother referred to her as a problem child, saying that her daughter had run away from home many times and she tried to get social workers involved, but her daughter had not wanted any help. When she finally stopped coming home, it seems the woman figured her daughter had found somewhere else to live and would return if and when she wanted to. Anele had originally been a victim, and as so often happens in human trafficking, she'd been coerced into becoming a perpetrator. Now, I will say at this point that some of the news articles refer to there having been 5 victims in the barbershop on the day of the raid, but the final court documents only refer to 3. It is entirely possible that 2 of the victims chose not to be part of any court proceedings, or it's also possible that those media reports are incorrect. Either way, I only have information about 3 victims, and if there were 2 others who chose not to participate, then it's probably fair not to include them here either. With the 3 girls being recovered, you may be imagining heartwarming scenes of reunification with their anxious parents. But that is not what happened. In fact, up to a week after the girls had been found, Unati's mom still had not been given access to her daughter. She complained about this to a journalist, saying that she'd heard horror stories about the conditions her daughter was subjected to, and all she wanted to do was comfort her child and make her feel safe again. I can only guess that the reason the girls were not immediately reunited with their parents is because police wanted to get the victims medical assistance, especially since they were likely experiencing withdrawal symptoms from the drugs they were forced to use. And perhaps the police also wanted to get their statements and maybe have them get some initial counselling before they were reunited with their parents. I'm certainly no expert, so perhaps this is the correct protocol to follow with victims of trafficking. But the victims only got to see their families quite some time after they were recovered by police. A sex worker from the area who did not work with or for Obi also spoke with journalists covering the case. The 23-year-old woman told them that she had once helped a 15-year-old girl who'd been a victim of Obi's. The girl had told her that she was from Cape Town, and she'd been brought to the barbershop under false pretenses, having been told that she would be taught hairdressing and given an internship. As had been the case with Sandile, Tandi and Unati, it hadn't taken very long for her to figure out that she'd been lied to and was in a very dangerous situation. The older woman said the girl had begged for her help to escape, and she'd taken her to a police station, ensuring she spoke with only police officers who the more experienced woman knew were not paid off. In addition, the girl had to agree not to lead officers back to the barbershop. The older woman knew she would be in deep trouble if the shop got raided on account of her. As it was, once Orby realised that the girl had made a break for it and found out who'd taken her to the police station, the woman was threatened and she had to leave the area for a while. When she returned, there were new girls at the barbershop. When the trial of the 3 accused began, the horror of the victim's experience was revealed. In addition to everything I've mentioned, the victims also told the courts that sexually explicit photographs were taken of them and these photographs were used to advertise them on websites that catered for the sex trade. Honestly, I was quite surprised at this public display of victims of trafficking and how the perpetrators clearly weren't that concerned with them being found. Of course, it makes sense to an extent because people trying to make appointments through this website would be screened by the traffickers. But also, the pictures on these sites rarely show clear views of the faces of the women being advertised. It was also revealed that the victims were forced to watch pornography with Obi and his cohorts. Sickeningly, this content was framed to the victims as training for the sex work they were being forced to carry out. The victims were often in the same room when they were raped, assaulted, or otherwise abused, so they were able to back up each other's stories in court. In addition to this, the state of the premises in which the girls were forced to live was also brought to light. The mattresses they were made to sleep on were filthy, as was almost everything about the rooms. Photographs also showed the floor and the yard littered with used condoms. Edozie Obi was facing 29 charges, including trafficking in persons, using the services of victims of trafficking, rape, sexual exploitation of a child for financial reward, sexual grooming of children, kidnapping, keeping a brothel, and dealing in drugs, among others. Anele was charged with keeping a brothel and illegal possession of dependence-producing drugs. Luke Buerta was charged with possession of dependence-producing drugs. The victim's testimony had matched Luke's version, that he had only been involved in the drug side of the business and hadn't raped the girls or seemed to play a major role in the trafficking side. He did, of course, know about it and did nothing, but he wasn't charged with anything related to that. The state's evidence in the trial included the testimony of the three victims, evidence from two of the individuals who had initially been arrested but not charged, evidence from doctors who had treated the girls about the impacts of the forced drug dependency and multiple sexual assaults on their bodies, and testimony from investigating officers on the case. When the state rested, Edozie Obi took the stand in his own defense. Although each of the accused trials were being combined into one, as so much of the evidence impacted all three, each had their own lawyer. Obi, in particular, was claiming that he had no knowledge of the illegal activities that were happening at the barbershop and was essentially pointing the finger at the other two accused. Anele and Buerta, on the other hand, were acknowledging their roles in the crimes, although Anele's lawyer pointed out that the girl had in fact been a victim at one point herself, and they were both pointing to Obi as the kingpin and so-called mastermind of the operation. When Obi took the stand, his testimony was largely unhelpful to either his case or the court. The judge would later describe his testimony as rambling word salad, which had not ever come to a point and added nothing to the case either way. Obi had spent the 2 years it had taken for the trial to get going in prison after being denied bail because he'd threatened witnesses. During the trial process, Anele had been sitting next to him in the dock when she'd suddenly let out a cry of distress, jumped over the seats and ran to sit next to her lawyer, with tears streaming down her face. She alleged that Obi had leaned over and threatened her during the proceedings. In September 2019, Judge Natvaral Ranshod handed down his verdict. He found Edozie Obi guilty of 23 of the 29 charges against him. He found Anele guilty of the 2 charges against her and Luke Buerta guilty of possession of a dependence-inducing drug. A few days later, in sentencing, the judge was scathing toward Orby. He accurately described the crime of human trafficking as a criminal process rather than a criminal act, and admitted that there were far too many other people involved in the process for them to be able to bring every single one to justice. But he was confident that Orby was the kingpin of this particular operation, and without him, the horrors the victims had experienced would not have occurred. He highlighted how trafficking for the purposes of sexual exploitation was a crime that's unlike theft, where you steal a physical object once in a single criminal act, actually stole from the victims over and over, in a manner that could never be put right, no matter how many years imprisonment he handed down. The predominant legislation the judge was using for sentencing was the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Act, which was signed into law in 2013. The Act provides for a maximum sentence per charge of life, or a fine of 100 million rand. In all, Judge Ranshod handed down 6 life sentences and an additional 129 years imprisonment to Edozie Orby. Orby stared ahead, expressionless. In turning to Anele, Judge Ranshod acknowledged a social worker's report about how well she had progressed in the 2 years since her arrest. Anele had been given bail, and she'd also been directed to rehabilitation services, which she'd seemingly embraced, and was no longer using drugs. She had also given birth to a baby, and according to the social worker, seemed to be set on a far healthier path than when she'd been arrested. Taking this into account, the judge sentenced Anele to 5 years imprisonment, suspended for 3 years. So if she was found guilty of similar charges within 3 years of the sentence commencing, she would have to serve 5 years for these crimes. But she would not be required to serve any immediate prison time. Luke Buerta, too, was on the receiving end of Ranshod's mercy, as he also received a suspended sentence, with the judge giving him a 3-year sentence, suspended for 3 years. He encouraged Buerta to receive treatment for his substance use disorder to ensure that he did not find himself affiliated with someone like Edozie Orby and feel bound to involve himself with the horrific crimes that had been perpetrated upon these child victims. And with that, Anele and Luke Buerta were free to leave, and Edozie Orby was taken down to begin serving his 6 life sentences. The 3 victims of this crime, who were included in the court case, could also start to figure out what their lives would look like in this new reality they'd been forced into. Throughout the research and writing of this episode, a question continued to linger in my mind. We know about Zandile, Thandi and Unati. And we know that there were possibly 2 other victims in the barbershop at the same time who were not part of the court case. But what about the others? Because there had to be other victims. I have no doubt of that. Edozie Orby did not just victimize young girls for the 2 years we know about, and the sum of the victims could not have been only the girls who were found there on that day. We know of at least 1 other 15-year-old girl who the older sex worker not linked to Orby said she'd helped escape. So, how many others were there? And where are they? What happened if you escaped one too many times? What happened if you refused to comply? We know from research and data around human trafficking that it's not unheard of for traffickers to sell their victims on to other trafficking rings. It's also not uncommon for victims to be killed if they become a burden to the traffickers or if they're unable to continue carrying out the forced labour they're taken for, whatever form that might take. Some victims, like Anele, become perpetrators. But what happens to the others? It is very clear to me that Edozi Obi was serving a very particular sector of the sex work market. Men who wanted very young teenage girls. All of his victims were in a particular age group. Of course, it's probably also easier to control victims in that age group. But it's also more risky to kidnap them, because it's far more likely their parents will come looking. So what happened to girls like Zandile, Tandi, and Unati when they aged out of the group these men were looking for? Did they even live long enough to age out? And speaking of the men who made this trafficking ring profitable, the so-called customers, the part that always gets left out when we talk about sex work, whether through trafficking or not. There's absolutely no way that you can tell me that the men who were raping these girls did not know that they were 13, 14, and 15. There is no way that they did not see they were altered by drugs that they'd been forced to take, or that they were most certainly not willingly taking part in the sex work. Who are these men? Where are they? Well, if the Gisele Pellico case in France is anything to go by, they are your postman, your doctor, your policeman, your lawyer, your neighbour, your brother, and maybe even your husband. If you don't know what I'm referring to, Gisele Pellico was a victim in a mass rape trial that recently took place in France, where the woman was drugged and raped for almost a decade by up to 100 men in her small French village, all orchestrated by her husband. These men would find Gisele's husband on a website specifically set up to help men find victims they could rape while they were unconscious. Of course, it's a very different type of case than what I'm discussing today. But it just goes to show that if we want to know who these people are, we probably don't need to look very far. And yes, I'm well aware that there are female pedophiles, hebephiles, and rapists too. And women are also perpetrators of trafficking and use services within the sex trade. I talk about that all the time. But that's not the topic of this conversation. Edozi Obi is a vile individual who preyed on young girls. But he could not have done so without being enabled by the people who would buy the services he sought to sell. He would not have had a market if there was not a whole lot of men looking to sexually abuse barely pubescent children. I think that's one of the things I can't wrap my head around when I talk about what was done to these victims. They were 13 years old. 13. And this case is just one instance. One barbershop in one street, in one town, in one country. The vastness of the possibility of how much of this is going on right now around the world blows my mind. I think as hard as it is to listen to the details, it's vitally important for us to hear about these cases, because it brings this sometimes vague idea we have about human trafficking into the stark focus of reality. For the parents among listeners, hopefully it helps to encourage a little closer look at your teen's social media presence and what's happening on their cell phones. And most importantly, just having these conversations about the reality of what is happening in the world. It's scary and horrible and not exactly fun dinner table conversation. But I think that sharing stories like this is how we honor the girls and boys, women and men who find themselves trapped in human trafficking situations across the world. Because I don't know about you, but I can't stop picturing all the other victims. The ones who weren't saved, or haven't been yet. And knowing the details of what these three girls endured makes it even more urgent that we start to shift the general thinking that allows these rings to continue to operate. This time, it was a barbershop in Springs. Tomorrow, it might be the house next door to you. Tandi, Zandile and Unati, hold your heads high and hold on to the power that has always been yours. He has already stolen more than was his to take. Now, he's the prisoner and you are free. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.